Now we want to take a Friday break from the news with a look at the thinking around the world on parenting. Did you know that in Germany, children can attend forest kindergartens? They spend the entire day outside. In Japan, mothers encourage their kids to fight with pretend swords and guns. In Scandinavia, kids nap outdoors. Now, much about parenting is the same around the world, but much is different, as mother and author Christine Groslow discovered when she lived in different countries to research her new book, Parenting Without Borders, Surprise Lessons Parents Around the World Can Teach Us. And she joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's just so fun. Just start with Japan, where you lived for a while as a parent. Mm-hmm. Just what were some of the things that the culture shock that you faced?
Well, I think the very first thing that I noticed that was really surprising to me was when we first visited my son's new preschool. It's a preschool kindergarten, ages 3 to 6. And we saw the children were all playing outside, running around. And it seemed like they had very little adult supervision. And I thought maybe they were having recess or something. It turned out that this was actually how they spend the bulk of their day at this preschool. And it's a very common way. They like for the children to spend a lot of time with each other with minimal adult intervention so that they can learn how to get along with each other.
Well, I mentioned that Japanese parents don't mind their kids having play swords and
guns.
Right. They don't mind their kids fighting. They don't interfere. It's sort of let them figure it out.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, if it gets extreme, a parent will certainly intervene or a teacher will, but they give them a lot more freedom to explore their play with one another, including that sort of play fighting that I was ever used to here in America. I would be, you know, jumping in and sort of making sure everything was all right. And I just had to sort of adjust to a different way of parenting when I was a parent in Japan.
In fact, you caught parents really staring at you when you were at a playground. You went with your child to play.
Encourage them? Or? Yeah, just follow along, make sure they're okay. And, you know, I realized that I was the only parent really doing this, especially with a child of my children's age, which was, you know, between 3 and 5 years old. By then, these children in Japan were really left to be on their own a lot more than I saw here. And, you know, they might have scrapes, they'd have disagreements, but that was okay. In fact, that was considered good for them because it was part of how they learned how to get along with one another.
Let's tell people how you came to this. Your parents came to the U.S. from South Korea.
Right.
And then, as we said, you spent some time in Japan and then decided to, you know, investigate further. What are some other cultural differences between the way U.S. parents parent and other parents do? Sweden, China, Finland, Germany. Give us just a couple more examples of how it's different.
Right. Well, one thing that I found very interesting was that Sweden was actually also very similar to Japan in the approach toward child autonomy. Children, when they're very young, are expected to be quite dependent. In Japan, they co-sleep. In Sweden, I found that a lot of children co-sleep with their parents as well because it's considered the child's right. You know, if they need to be with their parent during the night. That said, when they get older, these same children who, from our point of view, might seem very dependent are becoming incredibly independent in ways that we don't typically see American children becoming. They're walking to school on their own. They're not having their lives structured and scheduled away. And then you brought up the example of China and Korea. I was very interested in those countries because I'm from an Asian American family, and in China, for instance, what I found most interesting was this idea that as children grow older, as they become preteens and teenagers, they shouldn't be pulling away from the family so much as sort of being reminded of their obligation to their family. Now, we hear this word obligation. We think that's terrible. We think we're putting pressure on our children. Mm-hmm. But an American researcher who has studied both Chinese and American preteens has found that this idea of obligating your children, giving them a sense of responsibility to the family, actually helps their school achievement. So I found this a really instructive sort of lesson that we could learn from too.
It's the reverse in many ways of the other thing that you note that American parents are more likely to do, which is instead of telling kids the obligation they have to the family, and again, we're broad brushing, of course, a lot of families do, but we in this country feel the need to applaud them and tell them how good they are as individuals.
Right. We have this idea about self-esteem that you can instill it in a child from the outside by sort of praising him a lot. That's how you give him confidence. And what I found in many other countries was that the idea of self-esteem is different. It's something that a child gets from persevering, you know, going through a difficulty and coming out on the other side overcoming something.
Yeah. You quote psychology professor Jean Twenge, who's been on this program, who writes, "We simply take it for granted that we should all feel good about ourselves. We're all special. You know, we tell kids they can be anything." And then in Sweden, what? It's sort of, hey, just be okay?
Yes, and that's sort of a very surprising concept, I think, to a lot of us, because in our culture, we're really encouraged to make the most out of each child's individual potential. In fact, if we don't, we're sort of failing as parents. But the fact is that there's a lot of happiness that lies in things that come not from pursuing individual achievements, but from connecting with others and having a sort of a more sane pace of life, a more relaxed pace of life, and being able to pursue your own interests, which is harder to come by in a culture which is very achievement-driven with a lot of scheduling for children because we think that that's what they'll need.
It's Christine Groslow. Her book is Parenting Without Borders, Surprise Lessons Parents Around the World Can Teach Us. We'll have more of what she found in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now, and a little later in the program today, Senator Bob Casey and a leading Afghan activist will talk to us about protecting women in Afghanistan now and as U.S. troops leave. But right now, we're continuing our look at parenting around the world. Author Christine Groslow was raised in the U.S., but when she lived in Japan, mothers there were astounded at how she hovered around her kids, helped them navigate the playground, stopped fights. She decided to look at parenting around the world, and her new book is called Parenting Without Borders. Christine, pick up where we were at the break. You say American parents tell their kids they're so special, that they can be anything, they're the best, the goal to build self-esteem. You say one of the results is American kids end up overestimating their own ability. You quote a stat about college freshmen. 70% of them reported that their academic ability was in the top 10%.
Right.
It's not.
It's impossible for it to be so. And yeah, one of the good things about having confidence, which I think that Americans are very good at trying to instill in their children, is that it does make you feel like you can, that it's in your power to try and go after something if you want to. But the flip side of that is without a sort of realistic view of what you need to do to get better at something, you're never going to be able to get better. And I really do think that this attitude is at the heart of one of our problems as a nation when it comes to our global competitiveness in the world. Because if you look at the countries which are all doing much better than ours when it comes to academic achievement, they're not telling their children that they're in the top 10%, even though they're not. And they also have been told and taught that there's so much worth in giving things your all and giving things a good effort.
Yeah. Talk about food. Mm-hmm. We know in France it's right. Primary. But in Japan, you say that food education is part of the regimen. Kyuku?
Right.
Kuiku?
Shokuiku is food education, and it is an actual class in Japanese elementary school. Six children will take turns every day. Every week, they'll be serving the other children the food that's been made. Then the children all sit down and wait to start together. And then after they've all conversed and had their meal together, all the children help to clean up the school after lunch. You know, these are all sorts of like character building parts of the curriculum that we may hesitate to think should be required of our children at school. But I personally know a lot of parents would be really happy if their schools reinforced the sorts of values that they are trying to instill at home.
There's a lot of funny anecdotes. You come back after several years, and I think it was Japan, mm-hmm. and you see a father, you know, mm-hmm. applauding his child because he rode on a merry-go-round,
right,
which
right.
entails no skills, and it shocked you. You're starting to be the parent that's looking right. at someone else in shock. There's another anecdote about when you were in Japan, I think it was your daughter who fell on a playing field and you got up to help her. And
right, a friend's daughter, yes. And her friends on either side of her actually held her back because they were sure that her daughter would want the good feeling of getting up by herself and finishing the race.
What about the children who are allowed to roam far more than here? We know, I mean, we had Lenore Skenazy mm-hmm. on the show. She's the one
yes.
who let her 9-year-old
yes.
ride
right,
the subway.
Yeah.
I mean, vilified.
Yeah.
I can hear Americans saying, well, those are rural areas. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nice to have a forest school mm-hmm. in some rural hamlet in Germany. Mm-hmm. We have Waldorf schools mm-hmm. in this country where kids spend a lot of time mm-hmm. outside. But you can't transfer something like that to the inner city or even a city or a crowded suburban area.
Right. And I understand that sort of point of view, because when you don't see it being done around you, especially if your child is the only one who's going to be, say, walking to school alone, which has happened in our case when we came back to the States, of course.
Wait, how old was your child?
Our boys were 6 and 9. And they walked to school by themselves.
How far?
It was not far. This is the thing. They had been used to walking a mile to school each way through Tokyo traffic in Japan.
How did you do that?
You know, the first time it wasn't easy. The way we did it in Japan, when my first son was doing it, was I followed him to school. I walked with him to school, actually, the first few times. Then I followed him, and then I would meet him halfway, and then one time I just sort of let him go. And, of course, I was standing by the door waiting for him to come home. But I'd seen so many children who were able to do it that I knew that it wasn't as though he was developmentally incapable of doing it. It was more of a cultural norm that was holding us back. When we came back and our children walked to school on their own, I actually did get a call from our school nurse at one point when one of my sons slipped in the ice and got a scrape on his way to school. Now, this is something that he knew how to handle. He went to the nurse to get a Band-Aid. But she called me to tell me about it because she thought that I would want to know that she didn't think it was safe. And, you know, I knew that this was a little bit of a countercultural thing to do, but I also had arranged with the woman who helps cross the children. She encouraged me. She said, I'll watch them, you know, whenever they're in my eyesight and all that. Because I found people around me who were sort of willing to help support me, and I think that's really what it comes down to, is if we find more and more people who are on our side and believe that children deserve a childhood where they're able to walk around and have fewer adult eyes on them every moment, then that really things can change. Parents can feel that trust in their children. I understand how hard it is to feel trusting of the culture that's around you, of the people that are around you, especially when you see so much in the media about what could possibly happen. But I also think that when we look at risk a little bit differently, and we don't say that, you know, there must be absolutely no risk, but we also look at the risk of what happens when we don't let our children have these freedoms, such as the risk of a child who's never been able to walk around on his own suddenly being let out to walk on his own when he's 10, 11, 12 or so, and doesn't have that kind of judgment, then I think that our attitude toward the way that we're looking at childhood and autonomy, competence, judgment, and risk might change.
Yeah. There's so much here. In France, they have this theory of frustrating children. It's called on le frustré, I think. Sorry for my French. But the idea that frustrating children is good
right.
for them.
Yes.
In Japan, no baby strollers have any cups or anything or holders because
right. they have no idea that children will be snacking as they're strolling around.
In Sweden, a friend of yours, kids went to a school, and they built two-story structures into the ice on a hillside. They scavenged by themselves in the woods. Mm-hmm. They ate wild roots. Her three-year-old school had no fence. But as you write, with that freedom, there was a lot of structure that you couldn't see. I mean,
right.
kids were taught what to do.
Right.
And then they come back to the U.S., this friend Brittany, right. and they bring their boys back, and they come to an American school where they were not allowed to pick up a stick
right.
off the ground.
Right, exactly.
For fear they'd maybe
poke
make it
someone
into
in the eye or make it into
right.
a weapon.
Right.
Exactly. Yes, I think that the key thing is that there's just a different idea of what children are capable of, and then from that, teachers and parents will proceed either to give children the guidance that they need to be able to thrive in those situations of greater freedom than we allow, or like us, we will protect them and sort of prevent them from having those experiences. And that is one way. I just argue that it's not the best way.
The one overarching thing I take out of the book, the whole book, kids need more time outside. It's pitiful in the U.S. compared to other countries.
Right, 4 to 7 minutes average on a weekday now.
For American kids.
Yes, it's really a shame.
Christine Groslow, author of Parenting Without Borders, Surprise Lessons Parents Around the World Can Teach Us here in the U.S. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
4 to 7 minutes on average American kids spend outside. Here's more. There's something researchers call surplus safety. Parents trying to protect their kids from rare risks and instead creating real ones like obesity by keeping them inside. Have you lived in other countries and noticed a parenting difference? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Brilliant Earth, committed to environmental and social responsibility with conflict-free diamond engagement rings, wedding rings, and other fine jewelry. Online at BrilliantEarth.com. And Olin College of Engineering, focusing students on the needs of people in the real world to ignite passion and innovation. Olin.edu.